Excellent. So, for this morning's Dharma talk, this is from Correct Tuesday. I must always remember the dates, because I think I remember, could have told you that story the first day of this retreat. But many, many years ago, when I first came to Australia, and we had a small place over in Magnolia Street in North Perth. And one day we had this gentleman came. He was from Nepal, but he was a little bit of a schizophrenic. And one day that he had an epileptic fit as well. So, you know, made sure he survived. But then we called the ambulance. It's the first time I'd seen the ambulances here in Western Australia. And one of the things they did was to ask this gentleman, sort of, you know, what day of the week it was. And he didn't know. He just had a fit. So they put him in the ambulance and took him to hospital. And that's when I asked the ambulance people, I said, why do you ask him what day of the week it is? They said, that's a standard question, they said. And if you don't know the answer, they think you're a bit crazy and they put you in the hospital. And from that day on, I always decided to try and remember what day of the week it was for my own safety. Because sometimes as a monk, because you don't have Monday morning going to work, you don't have Saturday going to the football, you don't have different days of the week meaning different things to you. And so because of that, sometimes the timelessness gets, you know, quite interesting. And sometimes people don't understand what that timelessness means, which means they think you're a bit strange. So I always remember it's Tuesday today, so if any of you have any problems, please remember Tuesday. But the main topic for the talk today was just about the problems which come up in meditation. Because I've been talking this way, that way about meditation. This is coming towards the middle of the retreat now. And towards the middle of the retreat, now some of the tiredness should have been overcome, not all of it, because sometimes you have ordinary tiredness, but some of the main tiredness should be overcome, and the understanding what you're supposed to be doing and how you're supposed to be doing it has been understood. And you know the people in your rooms. And one thing I would say, though, that when somebody said, oh, please remind people not to make too much noise in their rooms, that people try their very best, but it won't always be perfectly quiet. And that's one of the reasons why, that if you think about it and contemplate it, if somebody does bang the door, how long does that sound last for? Bang! About 2 seconds. But then it echoes in your mind. What did they do that for? They should know better. I know who that is. I'm going to tell them off. I'm going to ask Ajahn Brahm. I'm going to write a question this evening to make sure that people don't do that anymore. I'm going to take their names, and so we can actually, next time, we'll get Lehar to put all the door bangers in the same room, or the same cottage, so they can bang as much as they like, but all the quiet people will have our cottage. And then you find out that you've just disturbed your mind for about 5 minutes. Which is the most noisy? Your reaction or the noise itself? So we try to limit the noise as best we can out of compassion. But when a noise does happen, just please be kind, be compassionate, and just let it go, drop it straight away. And you can see here that our reactions, when they become negative, it's understandable, but nevertheless, when they do become negative, that's where we learn how to let go more quickly. You can't sort of wind the clock back and make sure that noise never happened. But what you can stop the echoes of that noise in your mind by just not letting it go. And of course, this is what the Ajahn Chah used to teach us. usually the monasteries over in China were quiet, but every once, twice, or three times a year, they had big festivals and parties. And I remember this occasion because this was the first time that they had discovered generators. There's no electricity in the village. Generators and recorded music and amplifiers and big loudspeakers. And my goodness, even though the village was over a kilometer away, when they ramped up the speakers and the amplifiers, oh, that was really loud. It was like you're in a forest monastery and you had like a big rock concert going on right next to you. And it was really, 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 really noisy. And what they used to do in the northeast of Thailand, it's like it was a Lao culture, much more than a Thai culture, that they would have the party till maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, and they all get tired and sleep. They get up in the morning and start again. It usually lasted for 3 days. So everything done is for 3 times in Buddhism. But after the first night, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, they finish, and then you can get some sleep until bong, 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 the bell went at 3 o'clock. So we're only getting 1 hour sleep a night at most. And so we decided to go. They wouldn't not listen to us, we were just young Western monks. But we thought they may listen to Ajahn Chah, our boss. So we went to see Ajahn Chah and said, can you please ask the headman, can you just stop at 1 o'clock? You know, just give us an extra hour so we can get some sleep. And that's when Ajahn Chah told us beautiful simile. He said, it's not the noise disturbs you, it's you disturb the noise. Of course, it made no sense at first, but disturbing the noise means you try and get rid of the natural fact that life is disturbing. And there will be noises sometimes. So just, if you can't stop it, just accept it and let it go. So when somebody does bang the door, please don't disturb the noise. In other words, you let it come in, and then you let it go. And it doesn't echo when you don't disturb the noise. And of course, the lovely story about that was there was one of the monks, about, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years ago, he told me that his brother was coming from Europe to visit him. And can he stay in monastery? He said, there's no space in the monastery. Just like this place, Bodhinyana Monastery is very popular, and so all the rooms were taken. He said, oh, it doesn't matter, you can sleep in my room, in my kuti. It's only a very small room, smaller than your rooms here, in the monks' kutis. And he said, I grew up with him, he's my brother, it's okay, isn't it? I said, yeah, sure. But then there was an elderly monk, and I said, I think your brother, being, I think, older than you, that both of you probably snore. Are you prepared to sleep in the same room as your brother? Because he snores, and you won't get any sleep at all. He said, no, 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 I figured all that out. My strategy is to make sure I go to sleep first. And that is a strategy. He said, okay, well, suit yourself. If you want to do it, it's up to you. So that's what he did. His brother shared the small room with him. And of course, his strategy never worked out the way he intended, because his brother went to sleep first. Really snoring loudly. And of course, his brother never knew he was snoring. That's a strange thing about some of my meditation groups I used to do in prison. And there's only about 6 or 7 prisoners there. But because it was high security, you always had to have a prison officer with you all the time. And so, 6 or 7, we started our meditation, and the prison officer was making sure everything was okay. And then everything went quiet. As I closed my eyes too, we started meditating. And then I heard some snoring. It's very good I opened my eyes, because it was the prison officer was snoring. And one of the prisoners had his hand right next to the keys on a prison officer's belt. The prisoner saw me, I saw the prisoner, and he looked at me and said, "That was so close." Another few seconds I could have those keys. But anyway, in this particular case, that this monk was stuck there, his brother was snoring quite loudly, and there's no way he could get to sleep. He tried to ignore it. It didn't work. He tried to just watch his breath. That didn't work. The snoring was too loud in a small room. So what he did was he remembered those teachings. It's not the noise disturbs you, it's you who disturb the noise. He was disturbing it with negativity and trying to get rid of it and being angry at it, being negative towards it. That's called disturbing. So how about changing his attitude and literally opening the door of his heart to that snoring and valuing it and finding it delightful? Because he was a highly educated European, that he started listening to that sound and imagining it was experimental, popular, profound music. It defied all sort of meter and all sort of harmonics and tones. It was just totally rebellious. But it did have a beat to it and a rhythm, sort of. And he started imagining it as experimental modern music, never been done before. And he told me this story afterwards, and I was just so pleased with him, because he said the last thing he remembered was this snoring was so musical, it was delightful. And that was the last thing he remembered when he woke up in the morning. And I thought, no, how great wisdom that is. Sometimes you may hear some snoring in the person in the room next to you. Or they're always getting up earlier, say, you know, to make a cup of tea or something. But if that happens to you, see if you can make that delightful in whatever way you can. And of course, the other noise, similarly, which turn what would normally be a problem into something very, very beautiful and wonderful, was in that retreat which I was giving in Sydney many years ago. Once the retreat, the 9-day retreat started, the first night of questions, there were all these questions, about 3 or 4, 5 or 6 of them, I think, all the same question. Would you please ask the meditators to breathe quietly? Because this gentleman was breathing very loudly through his mouth. And that was a point I told everybody in the room. I should have told him first of all that gentleman has got a big tumor in his sinus. He's got sinus cancer. And he told me when he first came on the retreat that, you know, the doctors had given up on him. There was no more treatment available. And he was just, you know, throwing the last throw of the dice, I think he said. Try meditation, who knows? He said, "I can't breathe through my nose. No, that's all blocked up with this big tumor. What I can do is just breathe through my mouth." And as soon as I said that to everybody in the room, there was no more complaints, but a lot of compassion for that gentleman. Because when they heard him, they thought, oh, what a wonderful thing this is. He's trying his very best to maybe just, you know, cure this terrible disease of cancer. So, you know, good on him. Hey, just breathe as loud as you can. I don't mind, because we have compassion. That compassion and kindness, that overcame the negativity. It was a beautiful sort of loud breathing noise, simply because they knew where it was coming from. And of course, a nice part of that story is, I often tell it in another context, the last day of the retreat, and actually we'd finished, and I had to leave early because I had to get the aircraft plane back to Perth, you know, to get back here in time. And you never actually know the traffic in Sydney. So I got in the car early. And as I was getting in the car, he came running towards me. And he said, look, please stop just a few moments. Because he said the last meditation he had, that he'd heard a popping sound. I always remember how he said it, pop. And he could breathe through his nose. Only for 1 minute. Then it closed up again. And he said, he wasn't imagining this. It was really, he could breathe through his nose. But then it closed up again. What's going on? Because I was in a rush to get back to the airport, but I did tell him, look, you know, he says, carry on, yes, you know, these things sometimes work. But myself, I thought he'd left it too late. That, you know, he just had a popping sound, but it's probably too late, he's going to die. But anyway, 6 months later, that I remember going to Sydney for another event, and going to a talk, and this gentleman came up to me, do you remember me? That's a really, no, not a very good question to ask a monk. But sometimes I've given really, really big talks to many thousands of people. And I remember one of those talks years ago was in Colombo in BMICH, about 10,000 people. And I remember this Sri Lankan coming to me once and says, oh, Ajahn Brahm, do you remember me? I was at that talk in BMICH. There's another 10,000 people there. But anyway, I said, I don't remember you. And also, remember, when someone has a cancer, you know, they get very, very thin, and they just gaunt looking, tired, skin is a different colour. So they look really sick. And this guy was healthy. And he announced, I was that guy. I carried on meditating, the tumour went. So I'm healthy now, in full remission. I'm just spending whatever time I have left on this planet just to teach that meditation to help others. Good on him. But I always remember that, the story of the noise. And that noise saved his life, and probably saved many other people's lives as well. So sometimes when we look at distraction or disturbance in a different way, sometimes it softens it so much. We realize we're disturbing the noise. It's not the noise is disturbing us. You can't tell everyone to be quiet. And sometimes, you know, you're not quiet either. We do make noise like coughing. Or laughing. Or dropping things. There's nothing wrong with that. And so little by little we learn that these are distractions which we make for ourselves. Now, in that chant which we did earlier today, we do every day, morning and evening, the Loving Kindness Sutta. There's something in there, there's a phrase. This is not just chanting just for the sake of making some noise. There's some beautiful stuff in there. And one of the phrases which I always keep in mind is, this is what should be done by one who's skilled in goodness. Let you be content and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. And that was, learn how to be content and easily satisfied, not just with your room or with the food or with the talks, but with your own meditation. Don't ask too much for meditation. Learn how to be content and really easily satisfied. You sit down, it gets peaceful. Well done, that's enough. Good enough for me. And I'm content. Don't look at all the things which are missing from your spiritual life. Look at all the things which you have already, what's here right now. It's beautiful, wonderful, this is great. I've been building in Bodhinyana Monastery and here and also in many other places for the last 38 years as I came here. How much more is there to build? And I say, I'm going to be content and easily satisfied. Yeah, there's other things to do, but I always remember, and I really spend time not planning what I'm going to do next, but appreciating what's already been achieved, what's already here. And quite frankly, this is an incredible retreat center. I've been to many retreat centers in the world. I've been to many monasteries in the world, especially nuns' monasteries, Dhammasara, Bodhinyana. I'm not just saying this because I'm the boss. I'm saying it is, they are beautiful centers. And Buddhist societies, incredible Buddhist societies, you've got to admit it, it's a pretty good setup we've got. And that after a while, one becomes content, easily satisfied. We want to preserve this, make it better if we can. But nevertheless, you feel so much contentment, energy, what you already have. Now, I'm talking about your meditation. How is your meditation right now? You look at it and say, oh, I haven't even got jhana yet. You've got beautiful nimittas. I just can't understand why people have a nimitta and they want more. If it's a nimitta, it's beautiful. Or just, yeah, they haven't got nimittas yet, but they can sit down quietly, they have some peace in their mind, they can watch the breath go in and go out. And then for 10 or 15 minutes. Well done, congratulations, that's marvelous, that's beautiful. But if you notice the nature of human beings, is not to appreciate what we have, but to always want something more. And this is, I think this was, did you write that on the board the other day, Leha, about what suffering is? That suffering is not, so it's all, so it's when you want something more, you cannot enjoy what you already have. Strange thing, but we've got so much source of peace and contentment. But when you want something more, you can't enjoy it. If you have beautiful nimittas and you want jhanas, you can't enjoy those nimittas. They're not good enough. I want more, 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 please. And sometimes, you know, you look back and think, why did I want something more? It was the wanting something more which was the problem. Not the fact you hadn't got a jhana yet, but because you wanted it. Now this is a simile, a visual simile, because sometimes you talk a lot and people feel they need to remember what was said. But a visual simile is always more powerful. So, Prashant, you're nearest to me, could you please come up? You've seen me do this before. Prashant is a very honest man. Is that the case? Are you honest? Truthful. Okay, Prashant, I want you to be totally honest. Tell the truth, don't exaggerate, don't try and please me. Now, this is my simile of meditation. You've got a glass, a cup of water, and the job is to make this water perfectly still. I mean, really still, absolutely still. So you can see the water, Prashant. Is it still yet?
No.
It's not?
No.
Why not? Why am I? Oh, I'm not paying attention. I will now pay attention. Be mindful. So stop moving yet?
No. More.
More, okay. Why? I'm not concentrating, am I? I'm not focusing. So I'll now be mindful and I'll focus. I'm honestly trying to keep it still. How's it going?
Shaking more again.
And this is how many people meditate. They learn mindfulness. Okay, be mindful. Yes, yes, but it's still moving. Then they focus and concentrate. And they really try. And it moves more. And so you can do this for years. And you won't, and you just think you can't meditate. However, this is not how you meditate. Not being mindful, not being concentrated, but learning how to let go. Now, is it still moving?
Yes.
It is. Is it moving more or less now?
Less.
Now what's happening?
Almost stopped. Stopped.
Stopped, yeah. Could I hold it still?
No.
You can't either. When you put it down and let it go, it becomes still all by itself. A big round of applause for Prasad. Please excuse me for being silly. So, that is how we meditate, being content and easily satisfied, not proud, not demanding. So what we're doing is we are renouncing wanting. We don't want anything, not even good things. So what's one of the biggest hindrances in meditation? You want something, anything. So that's one of the reasons why if you want to go far in meditation or go deep in meditation, you'll get nowhere. That's what the reason why that gentleman who had the sinus cancer, he only got a breakthrough at the very end of the retreat. I don't know why it's always at the end of a retreat that these amazing things happen. So it's only in the middle of the retreat now, so you've got no hope until the next couple of days, and maybe on Sunday you might get something. When you totally give up and realize how hopeless you are, and just, I can't do this. And then, like that one nun, I think the nuns over there know her, she was on a retreat, very, very last meditation. No, it wasn't the last meditation of the retreat, sorry. But she'd already finished. The retreat was over. We did all the ceremonies and stuff. Retreat was over, but her taxi to take her to the airport to get her at the flight home, it wasn't going to come until another hour. So she had, what she said, an hour to kill. That's how we say things. I don't like that saying, killing anything is not a good idea. That's one of the reasons why, you know, we should change a lot of the sayings in English. I really don't like the word to kill two birds with one stone. I like birds. So I never use that simile these days, to kill two birds with one stone. I use a simile to cut two carrots with the same knife. Is that better? Okay, it's getting there anyway. So anyway, so she was killing time. Never wanting anything. She was just an hour, just nothing to do. She tried meditating before, it wasn't working. Have you ever had that feeling, you can't meditate, it doesn't work? So she gave up. And after 1 hour, please excuse me for smiling, because it's one of the wonderful anecdotes. She came up to me, I was having a cup of tea or something, and sitting on a chair, she came up, she was on the ground, she was put her hands up and said, wonderful, oh. It's really cute. You know, she just had a real first really big meditation. And I loved that story because it was at the very end. When she'd given up trying to get something or get rid of things, where she learned how to be content and easily satisfied. Oh, I'm not going to get anything. Oh, I've just, you know, been really meditating a lot all this 9 days and not getting anything. Oh, what the heck. Should I tell this story? Leha, can you make sure there's no spare ropes anywhere in the monastery? You know that story of that nun, that bhikkhuni? That bhikkhuni, and this is in the time of the Buddha, 7 years she'd been meditating. That's a bhikkhuni. 7 years, she was getting nowhere. Now, you know, we've only done about 3 or 4 days so far. Imagine 7 years, meditating and meditating and just getting no breakthroughs at all and just all. And after 7 years, she decided what to do next. She didn't want to disrobe, because they said in those days, for those who don't know this simile, if a female nun, if a nun disrobed, she said she was going back to the three crooked things. That was a metaphor in the time of the Buddha, the three crooked things. And the first crooked thing was the broom. It was a metaphor for housework. She didn't want to go back to housework. Remember, it's 25 centuries ago. The second crooked thing was the ladle they made the food with. She didn't want to go back to cooking. And the third crooked thing, please excuse me guys, the third crooked thing was the husband. I didn't want to go back to the third crooked thing. So I'm not going to go back to the three crooked things, which is the broom, the ladle, and the husband. But then I'm getting no peace as a nun. So what she did, she took a rope, went into the forest. This is not a recommendation, okay? We're not going to pay out insurance if you try it and it doesn't work. But she went to the forest. She tied one end of the rope to a tree, climbed up a tree, the other end of the rope to her neck. Was just about to jump off. And that's when she got a, oh, so wonderful, oh, so lovely. The first breakthrough in meditation. Why? Because she let go. Let go big time. She let go of her wanting before she let go of sitting on the branch. Fortunately, yes, pretty close call. So that's that way of enlightenment is not recommended. The second way of enlightenment is recommended. And if, I tell this at every retreat, this is called the Ananda method of enlightenment. The Ananda meditation. That nothing to do with you, Ananda. This is Venerable Ananda. So that was the story of the Buddha's attendant Ananda. 25 years, according to the tradition, Ananda looked after the Buddha, made sure you know everything was okay for him, and tried to protect him when he needed a bit of rest. And Ananda loved the Buddha. When the Buddha said he was going to die, oh my goodness, poor Ananda was so devastated. The main reason was that Ananda wasn't fully enlightened yet. He'd seen so many other monks and nuns, men and women, come up to the Buddha and have all these amazing experiences, but not him. And he thought, if I can't get enlightened while the Buddha's alive, what hope is there for me when the Buddha passes away, and that's going to happen soon? And poor Ananda was just so depressed. I think that's a word to call it. But anyhow, after the Buddha did pass away, the monks came together and they said, we should collect all the teachings and the Vinaya so we can actually preserve it for posterity. And so they all had this big meeting and they decided to have a meeting 500 fully enlightened beings. They thought Ananda, he had such a good memory, was with the Buddha for such a long time, we have to invite him. So the meeting consisted of 499 fully enlightened arahats, and the 500th was Ananda. Now, to make the point very clear, at the end of this retreat, how would you feel? How would you feel if I made the announcement that all of you were had jhanas and had enlightenment? All of you except for you. Everyone else was enlightened, but not you. You'd be really sort of disappointed. So that poor Ananda wasn't just saying that he'd have to face 499 friends who were fully enlightened. He'd have to show up there and just, you know, being just the odd one out. So anyway, he decided the night before the big meeting to give it everything he had. He wasn't going to sleep that night. He was going to meditate, try everything he knew to get enlightened, so he could face his friends as an equal, not as an inferior, sort of second-class monk. So he really tried hard. He meditated, and he meditated, and he meditated. He didn't go to sleep, he tried everything he knew. And at the end of the night, when the sun rose, what had happened? Nothing. Absolutely zero, nil. And he realized, oh, I'm not going to get enlightened after all. And he came to peace with that. He became content and easily satisfied. Well, I gave it everything I got, so I give up. And so there's still another hour to go before the meeting. So he went to his room to have a nap. And they say before his head hit the pillow, he became the 500th Arahant, fully enlightened. He made it just at the very end. And to this day, I call that the Ananda method of enlightenment. So if you're not enlightened yet, haven't got deep meditation yet, go to your room and try it. Lay down. Take a rest. Let go of trying. Let go of wanting. And at the end of the story, wasn't most of you know this story, I tell it every year, and many of you come back every year. That's why I like the idea of having new people come into the retreat, because then I can tell the stories and the old jokes, and you haven't heard it before, and you laugh. And that encourages me. But anyway, that according to the story, that Ananda, on purpose, came late to that meeting. The 499 arahats had arrived, Ananda hadn't come yet, so they locked the door. And after they locked the door, that's when Ananda, the new arahat, arrived. He came through the keyhole, which is called making an entrance. And I was, wow, that's a pretty cool psychic power. So they realized that he was an arahant now. So if any of you want to let me know, that something has happened. We don't have a keyhole here, do we? What do we have? I don't know.
The door's not locked
either. But anyhow, that was a... And it's an interesting story, it's fun, but it's also important to know why that happened. He was trying and trying and trying. Now he let go. Really let go. His mind becomes still. When you're not doing anything, when you put the cup down, it becomes still all by itself. That water is incredibly still. There's no effort at all. So peaceful. So easy. When you know how to be content and easily satisfied. You know, to make the point, somebody was mentioning, I mentioned it in brief in passing, about just how the path of meditation and of insight, of spirituality, is learning how to lessen your desires until you have no desires. And I call this the two types of freedom in the world, the freedom of desire and the freedom from desire. And to make the point that it's a story which is in the books, and I've said it many times, because it's the best explanation I've ever come up with for enlightenment. Now, a lot of times people, I'm a Buddhist, I should become enlightened, that's what I'm aiming for. Aiming for what? Do you know what enlightenment is? It's like waiting for a bus and getting on that bus and you don't know where it's going. Do you want to get there in the end? What is it? And that's one of the whole story behind this started when I was a student going to a good school. It's all scholarships. The school was such a good school that they even had, it was in West London, Latimer School. It even has actors go there. Famous actors. Hugh Grant went there. And I don't know what his name was, but the one who was Professor Snape in... Yeah, what's his name?
Alan Rickman.
Alan Rickman, yeah. He went over to this school. And there's lots of others as well. And these days, because it's co-ed, it wasn't co-ed when I was there, they have all of these actresses and models go there. And I thought, how on earth can you study mathematics? Honestly, when you're sitting next to a supermodel. So, but anyway, good old days. But you know, actually, it's not that hard to sit next to a supermodel. And I'll tell you why, because once we did have a supermodel. Well, she was an actress, a Thai actress. He came to our retreat over in North Perth once. And the only reason I found out there was a Thai actress, really quite famous apparently, came on my retreat in North Perth many years ago. Because there was all these very young Thai boys who I'd never even seen in the temple, let alone learning meditation. That was true. So what are they doing here? And then someone told me, that lady over there, she's a very famous Thai actress. And she can't do a retreat in Thailand because, again, she'd get swamped. She'd come over to Australia and did the retreat there because that would be more anonymous. But then that got me sort of thinking, there's many other famous people who are Buddhists. One of them is like Kate Moss. Kate Moss is a very famous supermodel actress or something. Please, you know, let me know, because I don't know these things. But I know that she's famous. She's supposed to be very beautiful. And I remember just asking one of the guys who went on a retreat with her, a 9-day retreat with Kate Moss. And he told him, he said his story. He went on the retreat. He knew Kate Moss was on that retreat. But then he didn't know who she was. And of course he looked around, and which one is it? And he couldn't tell. Now, the whole retreat, he didn't know which one was Kate Moss. And he realized afterwards the reason was because, like supermodels, they are just like ordinary people, but they've got this type of face. You can, you know, use paints and cosmetics and, was it airbrushing? Is that right?
Yep.
Airbrushing. Okay. To make of this, like, there's such a blank canvas, they can make anything out of that. They say that's why they get on the front cover of magazines. In real life, they don't look like that. I thought that was really neat. So, in real life, they're not like that. The guys are different, though. Because I remember this one of our members years ago. And she was one of our committee members. She went off to North India to go and see the Dalai Lama. And it's not that hard to see His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I think she was our secretary or the vice president at the time of the Buddhist Society of West Australia. That, you know, meant something. So that she got an appointment, an interview with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. But no, it took 2 or 3 days. And I remember she told me that she went to do the morning meditation. So she went down and sat down nice and peacefully. And about 5 minutes later, someone else came into the room and sat down right next to her. And so, you know, just who it was. Richard Gere! Ah! Richard Gere is sitting next to me! Ah! She didn't make any noise, but that's called elation. And that just... he disturbs the meditation. He said meditation was gone after that. Human beings are crazy, aren't they? So anyway, so this similarly, I went to a good school, and they had a chaplain, and I was open, you know, to everything. So I remember going to see the chaplain, and I said, "Look, you know, please tell me honestly, straight up, what is God? You know, that I don't get it." And now he started to say, "Oh, you know, God is the ineffable." I remember saying ineffable, the beginning and end of all things, the Alpha and Omega, like the A to Z of everything, the ground of all being, the indescribable, blah blah blah. "Yeah, but what actually is it?" And he said the same again. And to me, that was all nonsense words. You know, it didn't have, the ground of all being. I know ground, you know, beings, but ground of all being? It didn't make any sense to me. "Come on, bring it down to earth." And he couldn't. So I just gave up on that. And later on, I remember asking a monk the same question. As when I was in London, "What is enlightenment?" "It's beyond words. It's the ground of all being. It's ineffable, indescribable." I've heard that before. Quite honestly, when people describe enlightenment to you, does it really make any sense? Or is it just something which is, "Oh, it's too deep for me, but you know, there's a very famous monk or a very famous teacher, it must be right." Don't ever do that. If it doesn't make sense, then it's probably not true. So anyway, what is Nibbana? I've got this beautiful simile. Again, many of you heard it before, but I again say you haven't heard it as many times as I have. Because every time I say it, I hear it. And that's the wishing game. In the wish, have I told it in this retreat so far?
No.
Thank you, you've got a very good memory. You're not old. That's why I also like teaching elderly people. They forget what I taught yesterday. And I shouldn't say this, this is not a very nice joke, but I also like going to the Cancer Support Association. There's always a high turnover of... Why are you laughing? I could have fun. I'll tell that to the cancer people as well, they laugh. Anyway, yeah. So, what is enlightenment? The five children playing the wishing game. Okay, it's an old story, but it's something really great in the end, the solution to that, this wishing game. The rules of the wishing game like this: you have one wish each. Who comes up with the best wish? First kid said, "If I had a wish, I'd wish for this new computer game coming out." Fair enough. Second wish said, "If I had a wish, I'd wish for a computer game shop. I don't get one computer game, I get many, and the next one which comes out, then I can get that too. It's obviously superior." The next kid said, "No, if I had a wish, I would wish for $50 billion US. With $50 billion US, I'd buy my own computer game shop. But the problem is, my mother always tells me I've got to do my homework before I play computer games. So, having bought my own computer game shop, then I'll buy my own school. Now, if I own the school and pay all the salaries to the teachers and the principal, they dare say I haven't done my homework, otherwise I'll sack them. So that way I'll get them to set me no homework, but always give me sort of top grades, because I, you know, own the place and pay their salaries, and if they misbehave, I'll throw them out. And that way I can spend all my evenings playing computer games and still get good marks. And of course, when I graduate from my own school, I'll buy my own university. And when I buy my own university, I can present to myself honorary degrees. All you people going to university, it's such a struggle. I don't appreciate you, but if you own a university, that's really good. Anyone who sort of back chats you don't like in university, you can... I shouldn't say this, should I? But anyway, you know what I'm talking about. And after After you bought your own university, play computer games all the time, there's anything else you ever think of you want, you can buy. Because $50 billion US is a lot of money. So that kid was winning the wishing game. The next kid was really smart. If you gave me a wish, my wish would be for 3 wishes. That's a wish. You've got to admit, 3 wishes is a wish. So, for my first wish of the 3 wishes, I'll have the computer game shop. My second wish, I'll have the $50 billion US. For my third wish, I'll have 3 more wishes. I can go on forever. Beat that. That's infinity of wishes granted. And the last kid. Oh, absolutely. It was not brilliant, it was just so wise. And the fifth kid said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content and easily satisfied I never needed any wishes ever again. That's the Buddha. The end of wishes. Freedom from desire. The fourth kid was the freedom of desire. Any wish you want, given. The last kid don't have any wishes. It's a very beautiful way of understanding just what enlightenment is. And if that is the goal, then how do you think you can reach that goal when you wish things in your meditation? You want things. You want to be peaceful. You want to be bright and not be sleepy. You want to be still. You want this. That is going on the wrong path. So instead, in your meditation, be content, easily satisfied. Don't desire anything in the whole world. And you're just sitting here, your head goes down. You're sleepy. You're not sleepy, the body is. And after a while, it comes up by itself. Weird, but I remember many times when I had sloth and torpor as a young man, and I just fed up with trying to put forth effort and put bundles of matches on top of my head and watching them fall off. And sometimes I just took those matches off and let my head go down. And then watch it go up again all by itself. And that was a weird and spooky thing, but really nice. You see, when the tiredness disappeared, it's nature, it has its causes. When those causes disappear, the energy comes back. But because I never did it, it was pure and energized and wonderful. And that's why sometimes you're just staying in this moment, making peace, being kind, being gentle. This moment, the most important in the whole world, what I'm looking at now, it may be restless, it may be tired, it may be all sorts of things, but I'm caring for it. That's the Emperor's 3 questions I mentioned the other night. And then, it gets peaceful all by itself. Because you put the cup down, the water stops moving. And all those little stages of going inside the lotus. You see the breath comes to you, and it's gorgeous. Because it's peaceful and gorgeous, you don't have to focus on it. It just almost like focuses on you. It's beautiful, it's delightful. And you just want to stay with it. And you stay with it, and as you stay with it, it's not passive in the sense it develops. It gets more and more peaceful. You don't do anything, you don't want anything. If I want any progress, I spoil the meditation. I'm just content being here. This breath is more than good enough. And as I look at it, it's so good enough, it's actually gorgeous. Oh, that's enough for me today. And then it gets even more beautiful. Ooh. And then you see this incredible nimittas. Wow, that'll do me for the whole retreat. And when you think like that, you don't want anything more. Then those nimittas get incredible. And you just go on this journey into the jhanas. You don't do it. You're not responsible for these, so don't take any praise. Don't take any criticism. They're just what happens when you get out of the way. And your experience is truth about what it's like to have no desires, to be content, to experience the second and third noble truths. Second noble truth, desire wanting is a cause of suffering. Nibbana is what happens when the wanting disappears. No tanha. Finishes. You up for that? So just let go. Be content, easy, satisfied. Not wanting anything in the whole world. And sometimes people say, oh yeah, that's good. So you carry on meditating. Say, let go. I don't want anything in the whole world. I put things down. Just like that cup in the front. Is it still yet? Hey, it's not still, look. Stop disturbing it! Leave it alone. Otherwise, people come and say, Ajahn, I let go for a whole hour and it didn't work. You're not letting go as a meditation practice. Come on, let go. Come on, let go! How many times do I have to tell you, let go? You can see just how stupid that is. That's not letting go, that's just playing letting go. Letting go is really just let go. And allow the body just to relax. Allow the mind to become peaceful. How it comes peaceful? Well, you don't actually, well, I've got to do this next, and then that next, that next. No, let go, for goodness sake. Totally, 100%, 1,000%. And then you find it works. That's one of the reasons why often people have their best meditations when they don't expect anything. That's one of the great ways of letting go. No expectations. So number one, lower your expectations. Come on, you're hopeless, aren't you? How many times are you coming here to meditate? Come on, how many times have you been in this meditation place to meditate? Who's been to now 10 retreats or more? Now be honest. Who's been to 15 retreats or more? Me. 100 retreats or more. You're not enlightened yet? Oh, come on. It's not about how many retreats you've been to. It's not about what happened in the past. Just let go of all your expectations. When you have no expectations at all, that's when you get deep meditations. The most times you never think you're going to get anything, then it works. Because when you have no expectations, it means you have no wanting. Just being here, enjoying this beautiful resort, not wanting anything in the whole world, learning how to be here. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Did you expect something else? Sadhu. Okay, so I wish you a pleasant morning. And interviews, yeah, very good. Okay.